Love is one of the most important subjects in the world. It affects us all in some way, shape, or form. Most of us desire to love other people and to be loved ourselves. And when it comes to romance, most of us wish to settle down with someone and build a life with them on the foundation of love. And yet, we can also whitewash love. We turn a blind eye to its uglier aspects, the ways it can cause intense suffering and even drive us to the point of despair. But in the life and works of one man, this darker side of love is displayed in all its glory. That man is Franz Kafka, and he was notoriously unsuccessful in love. More than that, he viewed love as one of the most terrifying forces in the world. And the reasons he did this are relevant to all of us, whether we are searching for love, content in our relationship, or alone. So, let's begin with a topic we can all relate to, and one that Kafka suffered from to a near unique extent. 1. Insecurity and love. I think one of the strangest and most pernicious trends of the past 20 years is considering insecure as an insult and insecurity as not just an unpleasant situation, but an ethical failing. Most of us are insecure about a fair few things. I know that I am. I feel the underlying anxiety and imposter syndrome that comes to almost anyone with a platform and a modicum of self-awareness. But Kafka suffered from crippling insecurity in a whole host of forms, and this heavily affected his attitude towards love in a way that most people would recognize in themselves. It's just that, characteristically, Kafka felt these insecurities with an intensity almost unmatched by any other person on the planet. Kafka lived most of his life with this background fear that he was fundamentally unlovable. This probably stemmed from his childhood, where his father Hermann was so overbearing and terrifying that Kafka wrote a 50-page letter about it. Hermann made it very clear to the young Kafka that he was not worth much at all in his father's eyes, and would have to constantly prove himself if he was to earn affection or tenderness. His mother, while not arousing the same panic Hermann did, seemed to regard her child as odd, and Kafka's best friend, Max Brod, said she never understood Kafka in the slightest. All of this left Kafka with a sense that there was something deeply wrong at the very core of his being. This is despite the fact that he was broadly very well liked by his friends, and he would sometimes read them funny passages from his writings, which were works very close to his heart. Sometimes, this fear comes out in very relatable ways. Kafka often complains that he can't be charming and cool-headed in front of people that he desires, and yet this is the very moment he needs to put his best foot forward. I'm sure we've all felt this at some point, and if you were to collect all of our embarrassing anecdotes we've acquired in pursuit of love, it would likely fill thousands of pages. But Kafka's insecurity comes out in full force in his more developed romances, in some exaggerated but familiar ways. His letters to Felice Bauer, his fiancée who he never married, follow a rather predictable pattern. He will interpret something that Bauer has written as proof that he has annoyed or upset her, and this will send him into a spiral. He will beg her forgiveness and become incredibly angry at himself. At the same time, he makes it clear to Bauer that whatever part of him has upset her must be the real him. He has no patience for himself or his incredibly human fallibility. To quote one letter directly, "What am I doing? Tormenting you? I don't mean intentionally, that would be inconceivable. But I'm tormenting you by my existence, my very existence." This pattern reflects a fear present in each of his more serious romantic prospects, that despite his best efforts, he is hurting the person that he desires. Kafka treats himself as almost radioactive, and sometimes believes that his mere presence is enough to cause harm. When he doesn't think this, he still considers himself totally unworthy of anyone else's love, especially romantic love. He opens his correspondence with Felice completely convinced that she will not remember him, despite them having quite extended conversations in the past, and even having agreed to go on a trip together. And he quite often expresses sheer terror that he cannot inspire love in other people. And this insecurity threatens to break out into guilt and shame at any moment. Kafka never relaxes in Felice's presence, but always detects some third eye, observing everything he does and passing harsh judgment over it. This feeling is also evident throughout his work, where most romantic encounters are judged harshly by other people. For example, when the protagonist of The Castle, Kay, sleeps with a barmaid, she is chucked out of her job, and the relationship eventually ends with her leaving him for another man. Here, we see two of Kafka's insecurities up close. One, that he is doing something wrong with his love and will bring ruin upon his beloved, and two, that, in any case, she will soon abandon him. Of course, this very idea leads him to push people away, because, at some level, he thinks that any romantic relationship is doomed from the start. In his letter to his father, Kafka confesses that one of his deepest desires is to have a family, but that he also thinks that this avenue is forever closed to him. He is trapped in a self-perpetuating cycle where he feels he cannot be loved, and so anyone who seems to love him must be deluded about his character. Thus, he will attempt to show them his worst sides. He will become erratic, distressed, and sometimes even angry until they too are upset. Their unhappiness will then confirm to Kafka that he truly is unlovable, and the whole cycle continues. On the other hand, when his beloved does seem happy with him, and he glimpses a chance at being loved, Kafka becomes overjoyed. He talks about how he can barely think of anything else, and how this has made him desperately happy. However, this state is only ever short-lived. Try as he might, Kafka can never stay confident in someone else's affection for him for too long, and soon he acts out again, taking even the smallest signal as proof that he is not loved after all. It could be a late letter, or a slight shift in tone, or just the mere suggestion that Kafka might have made them a tiny bit unhappy, and he is right back to wallowing in his misery. Any evidence that he is lovable is taken as proof that he is deceiving his beloved, whereas any evidence he is unlovable is taken as the damning verdict that they have seen his honest character. I think there is much to learn from Kafka's insecurity, because at some level, most of us are insecure about some things, and it's unsurprising that our insecurities are heightened around love. Like Kafka, many of us see love as one of the most important parts of our life, and so the stakes seem unrelentingly high. Moreover, in love, we are very concerned that our beloved knows us at a deep level, and not just some mask that we don, either consciously or instinctively. This is a prime scenario for any insecurities we do have to come bubbling to the surface, and those bubbles don't always look pretty. In Kafka's case, they manifest as a kind of self-condemnation, despair, and melodrama that must have occasionally made his lovers feel like they were walking on eggshells. And reading Kafka's vulnerable displays of total and complete insecurity can help us do a couple of things. The first is to recognize the destructive power our unaddressed insecurities can have if we're not careful. But the second is to be calm and patient with ourselves and others when they display these insecurities, especially in the messy arena of love. Many of us like to think that being vulnerable and working through an insecurity is a calm, collected, and thoughtful process. There might be a few tears, but fundamentally, it is an adult undertaking conducted in an adult manner. Kafka reminds us that insecurities often manifest more like childish paranoias than carefully articulated, therapized monologues. Sometimes, it's clear that even Kafka is acting on insecurity without even realizing it, and this is an author specifically heralded for his incisive knowledge of the darker parts of his psyche. If even he is sometimes blind to how his insecurities can puppet him, then perhaps we can cut each other a bit of slack when they temporarily seize control of us as well. At the very least, it can help us ask what insecurities are behind our own bizarre behavior, both in love and elsewhere. However, now I want to go one layer deeper and discuss one of Kafka's most profound conflicts about love, and how it mirrors a challenge we all go through in the horrifying realm of human connection. But before moving on, I want to take a brief moment to thank our very kind sponsors, Skillshare. Skillshare is an online learning platform where you can take classes on various topics. You can find anything from painting skills to party tricks to website design. So far, I've taken their classes on touch typing, interior design, and music history, and I've been very satisfied with what I've learned. Most recently, I've used their classes on Notion to get much more organized with my notes, and this has helped me save countless hours and just made my workload much more efficiently organized. Skillshare is a long-term sponsor of the channel because I have really loved learning different skills from them. I feel like I'm accumulating all of these little hobbies and tidbits that just make life that bit richer. The first 500 people to use my link will get a 1 month free trial of Skillshare, so please do click the link and check it out. But anyway, back to the video. 2. Independence and otherness. Almost all philosophers who write about love describe it as a fundamental encounter with something other than yourself, but that it also involves a shift in who you are. This can sound rather abstract, but anyone who has been in love will probably relate to this experience. You find another person so appealing that you both want to meld with their life and also have them meld with yours. This intuition finds voice in Aristophanes' image of lovers as two halves of a multi-limbed beast separated by the gods for its threatening power. While I've critiqued this idea in the past for implying the myth of the one perfect person for me, it does incorporate some classic experiences of love. There is the sense that love is the urge to mesh two people together in the same being, and that this process is deeply powerful. So much so that it strikes fear even into the gods. Because this idea that we let someone else into our being and insert ourselves into theirs is understandably terrifying. It conjures up images of invasion, of losing yourself, and of being taken over by an alien entity. The twin exhilaration and revulsion this can excite is wonderfully expressed by Kathy in Wuthering Heights, when she says, "Whatever souls are made of, his and mine are the same." And her subsequent self-destructive spiral is testament to the sheer damage this inner passion can cause. A key contributor to Kafka's own distress in love is that he views it both as an aspiration and as a threat. He is pulled towards being with another person, and yet he jealously guards his total independence. In his letters, both to Felice and Milena, he often indulges in fantasies about how he would devote himself to them, how they are the sole occupant of his attention, and how he wishes nothing more than to be with them at all times. But whenever the prospect of becoming close actually appears, Kafka retreats. He begins to view them as a threat to him, and as something akin to an imperialist foreign power. He doesn't tend to blame his beloved for this, but views love itself as the threat. To quote one of his letters to Milena, "These letters really are anguish. They are caused by incurable anguish, and they cause incurable anguish." In his letters to Felice, he complains that he cannot think of anything but her, and that this deeply upsets him. It disrupts his writing, and he spends so much time writing her letters that it's worsening his already dire insomnia. He speaks of his love for her almost as if it's a disease or an infection, one he both desires and is disgusted by. This ambivalence is also extremely present in his writings. In almost all romantic or sexual encounters with a woman, his protagonists find a potent mix of allure, temptation, disgust, and fear. To again draw from The Castle, one famous passage outlines the first physical encounter with the barmaid Frida, and contains the following. "There they lay. They raged and contorted their faces and bored their heads into each other's bosoms in the urgency of seeking something. And their embrace and their tossing limbs did not avail to make them forget, but only reminded them of what they sought. Like dogs desperately tearing up the ground, they tore at each other's bodies. Sheer weariness stilled them at last and brought them gratitude to each other." In Anna Schaffner's analysis of this passage, she points out just how well this captures the contradictory swirl of Kafka's own approach to love. There is the sense of seeking something, as if without love, there is a piece of Kafka's soul left unfinished. But the lovers also never cease their search. The culmination of their amorous embrace is not satisfaction, but gratified exhaustion. And the act itself is not dignified, but denigrated as animalistic. Kafka describes the lovers as like dogs, the same way Joseph K. describes his guilt-ridden and shameful death at the end of the trial. Likewise, this image of tearing at each other mirrors how Kafka sees his own feelings of love in his letters, as if they were openly hostile towards him, cleaving chunks out of his psyche with reckless abandon. This is, perhaps, one reason Kafka often prefers letter writing to actual human contact. As Julian Priest points out, Kafka repeatedly puts off seeing either Milena or Felice in person, forcing them to continue their relationship only by writing. This partly stems from the fear of genuinely getting closer to them. While he doesn't see them, the lovers remain confined to his mind. He can write the story of their love as he does his fiction. But in person, the sheer undeniable otherness of them is impossible to ignore. Although he looks back on some of his physical encounters with these lovers fondly, at other times they inspire a profound horror and fear in him. Priest notes that it is after their second extended in-person meeting that Kafka turns cold on Milena. The fear of becoming more intimate ensures that he will always keep his lovers at arm's length, even as he seems to beckon them closer. But, unsurprisingly, this extreme protectiveness over his own person and his independence doesn't bring Kafka much joy in the long term. In one of his most revealing letters to Milena, which he writes to her after over a year of absence, he says the following: "All my misfortune in life derives, one might say, from letters or from the possibility of writing letters. People have hardly ever deceived me, but letters always have. And not those of other people, but my own. The easy possibility of writing letters must have brought rack and ruin to the souls of the world. Writing letters is actually an intercourse with ghosts. How did people ever get the idea that they could communicate with one another by letter? Written kisses never arrive at their destination. The ghosts drink them up along the way." This letter is also written just over 2 years before Kafka's death from tuberculosis, which he almost certainly knew was approaching, and it has a distinct note of mourning in it. Gone is his previous preference for communing with lovers entirely through the page, and a tone of regret takes its place. The idea that he never made a real romantic connection with another whole flesh and blood human, but instead merely had intercourse with ghosts, is an exceptionally penetrating observation, and he identifies the cause of this as the ease of letter writing as opposed to forging a full reciprocal relationship with another person. In a tragic twist of fate, the very technology that allowed him to glimpse love within the realms of his own comfort also prevented him from ever pushing through his fear to the real relationships that lie on the other side of it. Franz Kafka spent most of his life very nearly finding love. He very nearly married Felice Bauer twice. He very nearly had a full-on relationship with Milena, despite her marriage to a philandering and unfaithful husband. He tells anecdotes of very nearly having connections to numerous other women. And yet most of the time, his love remains in the land of the very nearly, and never breaks in to the land of the here and now. The fears that Kafka has of genuine human connection are somewhat well-founded. Love is, in some ways, the insane wish to let another person who you do not control have enormous power over your mental states. It is letting someone into the viscera of your human emotions and sacrificing a portion of your independence and yourself to an alien entity. This is, understandably, a terrifying prospect, as anyone who has been seriously hurt in love can tell you. And yet, the severe regret with which Kafka reflects upon his previous lovers reminds us that the alternative is not necessarily any better. It is perfectly possible to guard your independence and peace so much that you become an unmoored vessel, adrift on a sea of isolation with no land in sight, and no other ship to lend you aid. the safety of solitude can very easily tip over into the delirium of loneliness. But this fear is not the only thing keeping Kafka alone. Alongside this comes a certain idealism that ensures that any encounter with a real person will not only be frightening, but also illusion-shatteringly disappointing. 3. Idealism and reality. If you've watched any of my other videos on love, then you will know that one of my favorite philosophers of love is the French novelist Marie-Henri Bell, better known by his authorial moniker, Stendhal. Another is the French thinker François de La Rochefoucauld. I don't know what it is about French writers, but they seem astonishingly good at putting some of the most embarrassing and vulnerable parts of love into clear enough language for this stolid Englishman to understand. And something both of these authors emphasize is that love is not just a relationship between two people, but two people and two imaginations. In love, we don't just encounter our lover, but our ideas about our lover. And they don't just encounter us, but are acutely aware of everything we could be. To draw from another great French author, Marcel Proust, we fall in love for a smile, a look, a shoulder. That is enough. Then, in the long hours of hope or sorrow, we fabricate a person. We compose a character. The key insight all of these thinkers recognize is that our love-fevered minds often aren't satisfied with merely observing the person we adore. They must conjure up images of their undying greatness or their sheer perfection or otherwise just exaggerate their earthly qualities. Stendhal called this process crystallization, and he saw it as the lover becoming a sort of object in our minds, more of our own making than of their real existence or essence. And although I admire all of these thinkers, in his letters, Kafka seems to extend their theories one step further, because he does not just crystallize his lovers and love for the better, but also for the worse, using his tortured imagination to construct a nightmarish picture of love that contrasts pretty heavily with his ideal. This general idealization process occurs both with his individual lovers and with the idea of love itself. When he writes to Milena, he often talks as if she is the most important person in his life, and he describes just how well she understands him. Milena was working as a translator, and Kafka was so impressed by the way that she translated his writings that he thought she had a unique insight into his mind. He places such faith in her that he tells her to understand more than he is saying, as if she has a telepathic access to his thoughts. Likewise, in his letters to Felice, he alternates between rapture and disappointment. At one moment, he truly believes that she loves him in a superhuman way, and then the next, he finds some reason to doubt it and breaks his own illusions, before then slowly building them back up again over time. Even looking back at their relationship, he maintains an idolized idea of Felice, describing her as incomparably gentle, self-sacrificial, and kind. He blames only himself for the dissolution of their relationship. We've already discussed how Kafka's relationship with Milena fizzled out after their second actual physical meeting. He is also fond of making love itself an idol. In his letter to his father, he associates a stable family life with the power and virility that he saw in Hermann, and he speaks as if love itself will redeem him for his inadequacies. The scholar Dagmar Lorenz argues that Kafka sees in love a potentially divine and redemptive force, and as a kind of magic. Yet only his imagined idea of love ever even comes close to this. We often see this pattern in his correspondence. As he glimpses shadows of his ideal, he becomes overjoyed. But then the messy business of reality rears its ugly head, and his hopes at redemption are shattered. This mirrors how he views physical love as well. While he admires love in the abstract, his writings on the genuine physical encounters people have with one another in love display revulsion and impatience with the conjugal manifestation of what he praises in the realm of ideas. This is a particularly stark example of how Kafka's imagined ideals of love are continually thwarted upon impact with real, existent, messy, flawed, and human people. And once again, This is highly evident in his fictional writings. To quote directly from Lorenz's chapter analysing Kafka's relationship with women, while Rossmann, Joseph K. and K. frequently turn to women to advance their cause, the women turn out to be less powerful and less interested in the protagonist's concerns than he imagines. Through his singularly active imagination, Kafka conceives of both the highs and the lows of love as far greater than they need to be. On the one hand, romantic love is meant to fill the hole left by his childhood, and Kafka views it as the way to save his soul from all his perceived failings. But, on the other, he refuses to accept that such an extreme ideal can never find purchase in the actual human beings around him. But rather than see those relationships for what they can be, he jumps to the other extreme and sees them as corrupting and perverse. The idea that love can be flawed, yet genuinely still worth having, is completely alien to Kafka. And his imagination does not stop there. Just as he crystallizes his lovers, so too does he crystallize himself. Occasionally, this is in a positive direction, viewing him as potentially a highly attentive and ardent lover. But more often, he caricatures himself as a uniquely evil and unlovable person. We touched upon this a little bit in the section on insecurities, but in truth, Kafka's view of himself is so warped that it becomes its own twisted and negative ideal. He sees himself as a uniquely harmful person, poisonous to whomever he gets close to. In one of his best-known works, The Judgment, he essentially spends the entire thing berating himself for all of his failings through this stand-in character for his father. Among his many self-condemnations is that he does not love others at all, but is merely tempted by the thought of bodily, physical gratification. But this flies in the face of just so much evidence about his life. Someone just acting out of animal lust would not keep their lovers at bay for months on end and insist on corresponding with them solely through letters. Nonetheless, this is how Kafka sees himself. He exaggerates his misdeeds and unconscious, slightly bestial desires until they reach extraordinary proportions. He describes himself as having ruined Felice Bauer and her family, even though Felice went on to have a long marriage, a successful business, and two children, and Kafka would not even have the power to ruin her family if he tried. When it comes to love, Kafka is so lost in his imaginings that it only ever appears to him in extremes. Either love is the supreme redemptive force that will finally make him more than a lowly sinful failure, or it is an indifferent power come to devour him. Either his lovers are superhuman telepathic figures who have a unique insight into his mind, or their relationships are torments, come to torture Kafka in his sorry state. Either Kafka is a devoted lover, writing endless letters and wishing to attend to his lover's every need, or he is a monster, destined to bring rack and ruin to whatever unfortunate soul arouses his passions. There is no room for the rather mundane middle ground to make itself known, which is unfortunate because, in this case, that is where reality resides. And once again, there is much we can learn from Kafka's extreme example. While I hope that not many of us have quite the same oscillation between an imagined heaven and hell in our own approach to love, imagination probably does feature more heavily in our romantic relationships than we might like to admit. Although many other writers have warned us of idealizing the object of our affections, and I've spoken in the past about the dangers of idealizing love itself, Kafka reminds us that we can also crystallize our own character in love. For some people, I'm sure this will involve an exaggeration of their strengths as a lover and how they deserve everything to be perfect. But for a lot of us, I think it will lean more in this Kafka-esque direction, where we create caricatured, unlovable versions of ourselves in our minds and so deprive us of even the hope that we could love and be loved in return. But in any case, Kafka lets us know just how active our creative sides can be, even unconsciously and especially in love. And he prompts us all to ask the question, what about my lover, or love, or me, is really there? And what have I imagined? However, My final point is not to do with Kafka's physical lovers at all, but instead, perhaps the deepest love he ever experienced, and yet something that also served as his greatest torment by far. 4. Kafka, Eros, and the written word. When we think of the word erotic, we immediately associate it with both romance and the conjugal act, but I want to separate from these for a moment. What does it mean to have a passionate, erotic love for something? Plato sees physical eros for another person as just one among many different types of eros that eventually stretches all the way to the love of ideas, knowledge, and of the good and the beautiful. If we look at Kafka's work, we see that the greatest object of his eros was not other people at all, but instead his writing. And, interestingly, the same strengths and weaknesses arise in Kafka's approach to this as there were in his romantic life. First, there is his passion. In some ways, Kafka's intense emotional focus suits his writing far more than it does his interpersonal romances. The benefit here is that his writings cannot become overwhelmed by him nor disturbed by his obsession. He can quite happily write all through the night, and while this tires him out, it also fills him with energy. He wrote The Judgment in one long sleepless night, and he describes the elation he felt upon its completion. He is now considered by many to be one of the greatest writers of the 20th century, so it's fair to say that this passion did reap its rewards in posterity. It also allowed him to develop a unique style that almost anyone can recognize. The events he describes, and the way he describes them, are so distinctive that he spawned an entirely new way of viewing things in terms of the Kafkaesque. I highly doubt he would have been able to accomplish this without a somewhat obsessive attitude towards his work. However, although his writing did bring him great joy, this came with extreme sorrow. Kafka's diary is replete with self-admonishments for not writing or not writing enough. He decries a lot of his work as total rubbish, and even declared that his unpublished draft should be burnt upon his death, including what are now seen as his three great novels, The Trial, The Castle, and America. No sooner does he finish a work than he begins to harshly critique it, and not in the sense of learning what he might change or improve, but rather as a form of ritual self-flagellation. We see a familiar vicious cycle of idolizing the writing he will do, and then becoming distraught when it does not live up to his expectations. In his letters, he complains that he is constantly trying to express something that just will not come out, no matter how much he toils over his desk. And until it does, Kafka thinks he will remain ill. And just like in his romantic relationships, this is always seen as a fundamental fault of Kafka's immutable character, rather than something he can change or a condition of circumstance or something to be worked through. His extreme devotion to his writing comes at real cost to the rest of his life. While he does see romantic connection as a threat to himself and his independence, he also sees it as a threat to his work. He even goes so far as to declare that he and his writings are the same thing, and when he cannot write, he feels totally useless. Tellingly, he uses insect-based imagery to communicate this, just as in Gregor Samsa's transformation into a monstrous vermin in The Metamorphosis. For Kafka, his work behaves almost like a jealous lover, demanding his attention and detesting the women that get close to him. It becomes one of the only things in his life that brings him any scrap of fulfillment, even as it continually robs more and more of his time, deprives him of sleep, and refuses to allow him the simple comforts of human companionship. As David Constantine puts it, writing is simultaneously the affliction and potentially the means by which that affliction can be escaped from and left behind. If this were an actual relationship, we would probably call this a disordered cycle. It resembles the dynamics of many very unpleasant pairings, where someone becomes both the source of distress and also the person you turn to for comfort. Many great artists and writers have recognized that their work takes something from them, but Kafka's takes everything from him and very rarely leaves him with an actual sense of achievement, accomplishment, or expression. Although Michelangelo said that he hated his work painting the Sistine Chapel, he still found the art of sculpting highly fulfilling. Kafka's relationship to his work more resembles addiction than straightforward passion. Yet, in an awful paradox, this is part of why it has such a unique feel to it. In every word of Kafka's writings, you can sense his profound alienation from others, his deep inner shame, and his continual striving after something solid and immutable in a chaotic and confusing world. Yet, all of these things, isolation, guilt, and disillusionment, partly stemmed from his relationship to his writing. Or at least, that was how he saw it. On a number of occasions, Kafka declared himself unable to love. But I just don't think that's true. As far as I can see, Kafka held a deep, overpowering adoration for writing, even to the point of sacrificing his peace of mind, his relationships with others, and even his physical health. Kafka's obsession over the written word strikes me as someone with an awful lot of love to give. If this love were harnessed and directed, I'm sure he would have made a phenomenal partner. He almost certainly would have been happier himself. But we also might not have his works with us today. In some ways, whether he knows it or not, Kafka made a great, loving sacrifice for the rest of us. His profound unhappiness, his deep loneliness, and his total devotion to his writing gave us the masterpieces we are fortunate enough to read today. They are labours of the most self-destructive kind of love, and in their pages, we will find examinations of every troubling and tender impulse in the human psyche. In this way, I suppose, Kafka's love was not in vain. The reason I wanted to conclude this video by discussing Kafka's love for his work is because I think it is one of the most extreme manifestations of sheer, unbridled eros I have ever read. I said at the beginning of the video that we have a tendency to whitewash love, viewing it only as a positive thing and attempting to carve it off from its less dignified cousins like lust and avarice. But this does not just stretch to interpersonal relationships. Just like love between people can spark both the heights of joy and the depths of sadness, love for anything, be it an idea or a vocation or an art, is an incredibly powerful psychological force with both light and dark aspects. Kafka routinely talks about writing as the main thing that makes his life worthwhile, and also as his primary tormentor. It arguably ran roughshod over Kafka's happiness, and yet it also gave us some of the greatest works of literature of the past century. What better instance is there of the sheer grandeur of love, both for better and for worse? But if you want to explore some more on the nefarious side of love, I have a video on the controversial philosophy of infidelity right here. I hope you enjoyed this video, and have a wonderful day.